Welcome to episode 141 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. As I mentioned last week, with the pressures of living in Tokyo and the need to sort of breathe some fresh air that got a hold of me and the other half, we took off to the Yachiho Kōgen or Yachiho Highlands from May 31st for a few days. Today we start to share some of the images that I brought back with me in a multi-part series. I wasn't going to spend the whole time photographing as we took a steady drive out over there on the Saturday because I'd actually been up until about 3:30 a.m. Friday night, Saturday morning, finishing up some work. We also started back at around lunchtime on the third day, so the only time for photography really was the last few hours of light on the 31st, which we'll look at today. And then, granted, pretty much the whole day from dawn till dusk on the 1st of June, and then the morning of the 2nd. It was nice to have a relatively relaxed time, though. Although, as usual, I couldn't resist getting up at the crack of dawn to see how things looked in that first hour or so of daylight. The main subjects that we'll look at are some wild rhododendron trees or azalea, and also some, they're basically surrounded by white birch trees, which I love to photograph, and some sort of waterfall shots on the end of the afternoon of the 1st. I'll also be trying to sort of intermingle some tips on using a relatively deep depth of field, which I was doing in many of the shots over this trip. And that's exactly the opposite to a lot of what I've been doing recently, so I'll talk about considerations when maximizing depth of field too. As is so often the case with my busy day job and then fitting in my photography, which is definitely like having a second full-time job for me, I didn't actually book the hotel for the Saturday and Sunday nights until Friday night. I didn't even book the days off from my day job until the Friday evening before I left the office at around 7 p.m. Then I had to get two invoices off to a client for my photography work, so I was really sort of leaving all of this to the last minute. Having booked the hotel and basically committed to that, the invoices couldn't wait either. So, as I mentioned in the intro, I was actually up until around 3:30 a.m. on the Friday night, finishing up everything that had to be done. The idea was to have a relaxing weekend, though, and get lots of photography in too. So, I didn't push it by trying to get up and do my normal sort of, just having a few hours sleep and then driving from either really, really early or through the night. I took a relatively steady sleep, so probably sleeping for about 6 hours from the 3:30-ish to around 9:30, then got up and had breakfast and started to get the gear together, ready to leave. And we jumped into the car after noon and had a steady ride out of Tokyo and over to the Nagano Prefecture. Having stopped for a bite to eat on the way, we arrived in the area at around 5 p.m, if I remember correctly, and started to scout out some photo opportunities. I actually came here in mid-May 2007, last year, and having seen a photograph of a wild rhododendron tree in the white birch trees, that's in this area, and it's the Yachiho Highlands. It's pretty famous for these beautiful white birch woods. The weather forecast had been rain for the Saturday and then clear for the Sunday, which was perfect, as I really wanted to photograph the rhododendron trees in the mist if possible, which basically, that's one of the things that I'd come for last year, but it was a beautiful, bright, sunny day, and so it really wasn't to be. And also, I couldn't find any of the trees flowering yet last year. And then, you know, when I asked the local, it seemed as though the late snows had held the flowers back. This time I was heading out here 2 weeks later than last year, because again, I'd heard that there'd been some late snow in April. So I was hoping to find some of the trees flowering. The other problem that I had was that I didn't actually know which parts of these birch woods had the trees in, the rhododendron trees. So, you know, I basically just sort of, I was driving around trying to see some spots where, you know, I could actually get into the woods. But I couldn't see anything obvious. The roads were empty though, so I figured that leaving my car parked, we were basically running out of daylight. And I just sort of parked the car up at the side of the road and then had a quick walk into the woods, figuring it wouldn't hurt. And as I say, the white birch have to be one of my favorite trees anyway. And because it was pretty misty with the low cloud, I figured that if nothing else, I'd be able to shoot some nice misty birch trees. The funny thing was, though, that within literally 30 seconds of walking up the hill into the woods, I started to see the odd rhododendron tree flowering in the mist. So I was starting to feel pretty happy about my choice of place to stop, and, of course, the time of year that I've made my way over here. Let's take a look at the first image for today, which is number 1801. Here we can see that I kind of got the best of both worlds with the beautiful deep orange, almost red flowers on the rhododendron trees, and then, well, tree. There are a few other smaller ones, but basically just the one tree. And then really we've got a little bit of mist, and then surrounding it, almost all of the white birch, all of the trees are white birch. So I was pretty happy about this. The mist was not that thick, so it isn't really registering very well here, but hopefully you'll get some sense of the moment. It was raining pretty heavily too. At this point, my significant other was still enjoying the fresh air of the mountains and happily holding a large umbrella over the both of us and my gear set up on a tripod. We'll look at maybe up to 20 or so images from this location, this few days, over this and the next few episodes. But I wanted to note that all but one of them were taken using a tripod. I'm a big believer in using a tripod to make the whole process of photography very well thought out and deliberate. Some of the images that we'll look at would have been possible without a tripod, not this one as we'll hear in a moment, but you know, I'm really just a big proponent of using them whenever time allows, not just when the shutter speed or the circumstances demand it. When I shot this particular photograph, I'd already been further up the slight incline there and shot the tree from a very low perspective, which is another image, that's number 1800, but I won't include that today for the sake of time. But I will put a link to all of the images from this long weekend into the show notes. What I wanted to mention, though, is something that I've mentioned a number of times before, which is to always be aware of what's behind you. I spent maybe 30 minutes shooting this tree and the surrounding birch trees in various ways, and I'd started back down the hill to where the car was. Whenever I'm walking away from a scene or a subject, though, to the great disappointment of my other half, I continually look back to make sure that I'm not missing something that would make a nice shot. I feel that when you are approaching a scene, you can be sort of more interested in getting in and working the location, and are all excited about seeing what's there and what the location has to offer, but there's no intimacy between you and the subject matter yet. You'll still sort of be exploring at this stage, you know, in the first stages, once you see and sort of home in on something. Once that exploration is done, though, and you decide that you've shot all of the angles that you want to shoot from, the lenses and the apertures and all of the things that you want to do, and you start to become more comfortable with the subject, then when you feel that you've exhausted all of the possibilities, you sort of pull the cord and start to walk away. But the fact is, though, you know, usually you haven't exhausted all of the possibilities, and you know, you probably really only scratch the surface, even if you do what I'm about to say. But I always keep my eye open, eyes on the scene as I move away from it, in the hope that there was something that I wasn't open to earlier that presents itself to me now that I'm more familiar with the subject or the location. Although I'd been shooting some nice wide angle shots with my 16-35mm f/2.8 lens, I used the 70-200 here for this shot. I'd moved away from the scene and was looking back, as I say, as I moved down the hill. And this just sort of framed itself up nicely for me as I did. So we can see that I'm sort of eye level with almost most of the ground there, almost ground level, as we sort of look across the forest floor from my lower vantage point. And I'd used the 70-200mm f/2.8 lens at 100mm. So the telephoto effect had compacted the perspective a little, allowing the trees to be almost on top of each other, but still haven't become, too compacted. There's a little bit of distance between them. I've placed the tree just off center towards the bottom right third and ensured that the trees to the right and the left are sort of cut off in a non-distracting way. I find that when you're in the woods like this, you really want to make sure that things don't get cut off sort of in the middle. So say you've got a big fat tree trunk that only goes halfway up the side of the shot or something like that. This is the sort of thing that you want to avoid. Just keep the edges nice and non-distracting. I'd used an aperture of f/11 to ensure that the whole scene was in focus, and that gave me a shutter speed of 6 seconds actually at ISO 100. So you can probably appreciate how dark it actually was at this time, at this, at the end of the rain, this rainy afternoon in the mountains. Shortly after shooting in this patch of trees, as the light was fading pretty fast now, we decided to head for the hotel for our first evening. After we'd rounded a corner on a mountain road heading down into the valley, both me and the other half gasped as we saw that the valley was totally enshrouded in cloud. We thought for a split second that we might have been gazing out over a huge lake, but there shouldn't have been one, a lake this size in this area, unless my map reading skills had been totally blown. There was a lake down there, but it just shouldn't have been this big. A few moments after starting to view the scene, though, it became obvious that it was cloud. Even then, though, for a while, it was sitting so perfectly in the valley, surrounded by the mountains. We got one mountain on which we were standing and the mountains on the other side. I guess that's what makes it a valley, right? Right there, though, there was a lay-by that we pulled into, and really it just looked as though we were looking at the clouds sitting on the top of a huge lake, although I knew that that wasn't the case. The light was fading fast, but it was a beautiful moment that I really just didn't want to miss. And we'll look at two shots from here, and the first one is image number 1802. It isn't as easy to see the clouds in the valley here, although they're there, because I've shot this at 16mm with my 16-35mm f/2.8 lens. The first exposure lasted for 20 seconds at f/11, still at ISO 100, so again you'll be able to appreciate how fast the light was dropping now. The long exposure has made the clouds close to me, kind of sort of have a lens baby type of blur. But this was not only expected, it was the effect that I wanted. Of course, the clouds that are further away are moving much less in relation to my position, so they aren't blurred. They're moving towards me at the same speed as the ones that are sort of going up above, but they are coming towards us rather than sort of going over the top of the camera, which is what gives the closer clouds that blurred look. I converted to black and white in Lightroom, and I dragged the blacks down a little to emphasize the heavy sky and also to bring out the black of the mountains on the other side of the valley. They've actually been more gray in the original. Again, as I've mentioned before, a tip on converting to black and white, There are so many ways to do this, but one that I've sort of latched onto is, I think I heard it from Derek Story. It was a tip that he picked up from someone that I heard on his podcast, The Digital Story. If you don't listen to that podcast, by the way, I think you should. It's, you know, some of it can be a little bit basic, but there are often some gems that to pick up for just about any level of photographer. And Derek has a very entertaining way of putting this, his message across. Anyway, I basically what the tip is when you convert to grey, just basically reduce all of the saturation. All you have, you know, if you go over there in the develop mode, you have the saturation sliders. Just decrease all of those to zero, every color, and then. You basically adjust the balance between each color and with the luminosity channels. And this is really what this does, is to help you to, it stops the shadow areas from going all grainy and muddy and sort of digital, which is something that can happen if you do this otherwise. So try it yourself next time when you convert something to black and white. I think I'm telling you what I heard. It was a few months back, but I think I'm telling you what I heard on The Digital Story. So basically reduce all of the saturation and then basically do what we used to say you don't do years ago, which was just to desaturate an image. But then you can still play with, the reason we didn't do it before is because there was no control. But if you move the luminosity slides around, you can actually increase the intensity or decrease the intensity of the red channel, changing it anything from black to white, and you can really just balance it all out that way and have a lot of control over the black and white conversion. I said that I was going to talk about getting lots of depth of field in this episode too, which I'm going to now, but I think it'll go on into the next few episodes as well. It was really a main theme that ran through this whole visit. For now, I wanted to say that I was not too worried about calculating the hyperfocal distance for my shots over these few days, especially in these ones, and I'll let you know why in a moment. But basically, you know, we're looking out at this sweeping landscape, and the whole, if you want the whole scene in a sweeping landscape to be in focus, then one of the techniques that you can use is something called, you know, focusing on the hyperfocal distance. And if you want to learn more about hyperfocal distance and, you know, how to use it to achieve what's called pan focus, then you might want to listen to episode 65 of this podcast, which I did, called Understanding Hyperfocal Distance. You might be wondering, though, why at this point I wasn't too worried about using it for this shot. But just think about this. Look at how far away from me that line of trees is, and think about the focal distance, or the focal length, sorry, that I'm shooting at. At 16 millimeters, basically the lens goes hyperfocal at 3.6 meters or 12.5 feet, even when wide open at f2.8. So if I focused, what that basically means is that if I focused at 3.6 meters, everything from slightly before that, around 2 meters to infinity, will be in focus, even at f2.8. Those trees that we see in the foreground here are a good 50 meters in front of me, maybe more. And, you know, I knew that everything that this side of the trees was going to be black anyway, so I could have shot this wide open and focused on the trees and would have been fine. Remember, though, that I wanted to slow the shutter speed down to emphasize the heavy sky. And also, you know, the lenses, although the hyperfocal distance is a theoretical thing, at f2.8, most lenses are going to be slightly softer than they are at their optimal aperture. So, you know, most lenses get the sharpest at around f8. But I wanted to close down and give myself a nice long aperture. So I closed down to f11, and that gave me a 20-second shutter speed. At f11, by the way, the focal distance is 1 meter, but we already know that that's irrelevant for this particular shot. Let's take a look at another image, which is literally the next exposure that I made, which is image number 1803. Here, what I've done is zoomed in a little, well, a lot for this lens, actually. I've gone from 16mm to 35mm, literally going from one extreme of the lens's focal range to the other. I changed the exposure time from 20 to 30 seconds as the light died. And I really wanted here to give us a feel for the clouds that I could see rolling over the edge of the smaller mountains in the distance there to the left. You probably won't be able to get really fully appreciate this in the web-sized image that we're looking at, but in a larger print, it's pretty impressive, very nice. You also get a better feel in this shot for the sea of clouds down in the valley, better than the last shot, I think, just because we've closed in, we've zoomed in on it a little bit more. And we can also now see the distant mountains and that wonderful dramatic sky. For the black and white conversion, I simply synchronized the settings from the previous conversion. No need to reinvent the wheel, as I'd just spent some time figuring out the best place for the luminance sliders for the previous image. Here, we also see more detail in the foreground trees, which, again, I've focused on. The entire scene is sharp because the hyperfocal distance, even at 35mm, note that this does change, obviously, by the focal length. But even at 35mm, the hyperfocal distance is 4.6 metres or 15 feet. I'd have still been okay at f2.8 even for this, theoretical again, just because the hyperfocal distance is still way before those trees, even at 35mm. I wasn't using a depth of field utility that I carry around on my cell phone, by the way, and what I'm doing here basically is I've used Barnack, another utility that I've talked about a few times, and looked up the numbers, the exact numbers, just for the sake of this podcast. The thing is, as well, though, you generally, as you do this and as you make the calculations in the field and learn, or even just sort of take a good look at these sort of things on your computer at home before you step outside, the more you do this, the more you become aware and you get used to the hyperfocal distance for various focal lengths that you use. So it isn't always necessary to carry around a calculator anyway, although it certainly helps when you're getting used to using the hyperfocal distance. Especially here, I knew that I'd be okay, even if I focused on those trees and let the physics of the lens do the rest. This particular time was incredibly special. Once I'd gotten the camera set up and was making a few exposures and just sort of standing there listening out to the sounds of the forest. The birds were almost all asleep now, but there was a little bit of chirping as they were all settling into roost. But every so often we could hear the pretty loud cries of what sounded like the dominant male in a pack of macaque monkeys, and they weren't too far away. As you look at the image to the right there, there's a large patch after the sort of the jagged silhouette of the trees. There's a large black patch there over the right, and that's basically a very deeply wooded area of deciduous trees, and this seems to be home to a fair number of macaques. And we'd also startled a pair of deer moments earlier with my headlights as I was as we were going around a corner. So just standing out here, I was feeling pretty close to nature, even though we were literally just a few paces from the boot of the car, or the trunk of the car. Without getting all Mills and Boone on you here, though, I'd sort of reached out and put an arm around my significant other's shoulder and sort of pulled her over, and we were just sort of standing there, staring out across this magnificent vista with, all of the clouds and the trees, and then there was the cries of the macaque and the birds settling down for the night. These literally final moments of the day were truly magical, almost spiritual. The hair on the back of my head had sort of stood up as I was waited for my exposure to end. Really romantic, right? It was this, though. the fresh air, the beauty of the land and nature, and the sounds of the wilderness that had brought us some 3 hours northwest of Tokyo on this murky yet beautiful Saturday afternoon. Ooh, even with the disclaimer, I did get a little bit Nils and Boone on you there. Don't worry though, it won't happen very often. So I'm going to cut this one off shortly, and we'll continue to sort of trace our tracks around the Nagano Prefecture in the Yachiho Highland area in the next few podcasts. One thing that I did want to talk about quickly though before we close is Tin Eye. A few weeks ago, Rick, in the one of the great contributors in our forums at the martinbaileyphotography.com website, he basically introduced us to a new technology called TinEye, which is a new image search engine that is building a database of images on the internet, which you can then search by, pointing. Basically, you point TinEye to one of your own images, and it runs a really very fast comparison on this currently some 4 million plus images that it has in its database, and then tells you where they, if your image is being used anywhere on the internet, then it'll basically show you the page that the image is being used on. The product is still in beta, and you have to apply for an invite to be able to use it, but once once my invite was processed, it only took 8 hours. A lot of the guys were saying it takes around 24. Mine took about 8 hours to be processed. But once that was done, I searched for 5 images just to give it a try. And sure enough, the 5th one was being used on someone's blog. It's a personal blog and not commercial, but still, I'll probably mail the guy that was using it and ask him to add credits and a link back to my website in return for allowing him to use the image. The point is though, TinEye actually works. I wasn't searching for my best images. The best of my best. But what I did was I just chose 5 images at random from my 2,000 or so that I have published on my gallery. And like I say, it found one, so I was pretty impressed. If you want to try this yourself, by all means request an invite at tineye.com, and this is literally just tineye.com. Also, those nice people at, I believe this is pronounced IDE, Inc. Incorporated, the company behind TinEye, noticed us discussing this on the MBP forum, and assigned my account 50 invites to give you guys if you want them. So, because I'm based in Japan, I might not be always able to get this back to you any quicker than the folks at IDE can, but still, if you want an invite, then you can email me at tineye@martinbaileyphotography.com, and I'll send you an invite as soon as I pick up your mail. Include your full name in the mail if you don't have it as part of your email address, as I need to include that along with your email address in the invite. I am really looking forward to seeing how this technology shapes up, though. It sure will be nice to have a reliable way to search for our images, especially with the Orphaned Works Bill in the US threatening to open up the doors to unauthorized use of our work by the, how can I say, more ethically challenged members of the photography and image using community. Almost certainly there'll be people that latch onto the loopholes that we see in the current bill. So thanks to IDE for TinEye and for the invites. We will surely put them to good use. For now though, let's wrap it up for today, and you just have a great week, whatever you do. Bye bye.
PhotoCastNetwork.com, your photography resource in the podosphere. PhotoCastNetwork.com.